The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture entitled Transition and Consolidation, The Life and Times of the Rabbonim Tzavaroi, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilu Nishmos, Rav Matisyahu ben Rapinchas, Yechiel ben Salim, Betova Basra Avram, Umirim Basra Feitel, Aleihem HaSholem, of blessed memory.
As the Medrash Tanchuma in Parshas Noach points out, the period in Babylon that produced the Talmud was one of historically unprecedented peace and tranquility. Although the Jews during much of this period had to contend with a political leadership that was closely linked to a fanatical fire-worshipping Zoroastrian sect that barely tolerated religious pluralism, Jewish scholars and scholarship were by and large respected and allowed the freedom to flourish and to create what is probably the most important work of scholarship and genius that the world has ever produced, the Talmud. After the vast majority of the Talmud as we know it had reached its final form, Babylonian Jewry was shaken to its very core by a new generation of infinitely more intolerant, fanatical Zoroastrian rulers who made life for Jews extremely difficult. Despite these difficulties, though, Babylon continued to produce Talmudic scholars of note. These scholars, referred to as a group as the Rabbonim Tzavaroi, these were the rabbis who Tzavaroi comes from the word Tzavar, which means to give, to understand. These were the ones who added commentary to the Talmud, as we're going to discuss. We know them as a group, but their individual names, for the most part, rarely appear in the Talmud. They left a rich but often little understood legacy. It was they who produced the final version of the Talmud. And it seems, according to Rav Isaac HaLevi, it was they that finally put the Talmud into writing. Their legacy and the story of their perseverance in the midst of a period of persecution upheaval is the topic of tonight's lecture. With the exception of a few short years under Roman rule, during the entire Mishnaic period, Babylon was controlled by the Parthians, an ethnic group that originated from an area south of the Caspian Sea in what is today northern Iran. They were by and large tolerant of the Jews, and the Jews during the Parthian rule lived in relative tranquility. All of this changed in the year 226. The Persians, from southern Iran, under the leadership of Ardashir, wrested control of the country and created a dynasty that would last for over 400 years until the Arabs finally toppled them in the year 651. They brought with them an intolerant form of Zoroastrianism where fire worship played a major role. The Talmud discusses their rise to power in the following way. And this is in the first page of the handouts. Rabbi Yochanan, it's a subject of a previous lecture, describe the verse Begoinovel Achisem, I will provoke the Jewish people with a vile nation. This refers to the Parsis, in other words, these followers of the Zoroastrian sect. They came into power in the year 226 with the founding of the Sassanid dynasty. He called them a goy novel, as we're going to see. Evidently, what they did was unprecedented in the annals of Jewish history. When Rabbi Yochanan was informed, this is in the year 226, that the Parsis had come to Babylon, he reeled and fell. He was realizing the tsoros, how much the Jews would have to suffer. When, however, he was told that they accepted bribes, he recovered and sat down again. One of the greatest favors that the Jews have had dealing with the Parsis and dealing with the Romans was that they were able to compromise their religious beliefs or political beliefs for money. And it's this system of bribery that kept the Jews viable not only in the Talmudic period, but almost practically to this day. It's interesting, just a historical parallel. I believe it was in 1942, that the Nazis, having a very strong link with the Slovakian government, wanted the Jews to be taken forcibly to the concentration camps. And Eichmann's assistant was in Slovakia working on the plans. Michal Ber Weissmandl, one of the great leaders, scholars, that period in Slovakia, and as a Yid, with a bold and pious, in other words, came into the Nazi headquarters and had a meeting with Eichmann's lieutenant. And for a sum of money, Rabbi Weissmandl was able to stave off the deportations for almost 2 years. This gave entire Slovakian Jewry a lease on life, at least for 2 years. Only afterwards, in 1944, when Slovakia was annexed by the Nazis, then there was nothing to do anymore. But money has always been, bribery has always been a means of Jewish survival. And there's always the fear that you're dealing with a government that will not accept bribes. This is very difficult. I was just reading a very interesting work about the shtetl, about life in Eastern Europe, and how the Jews, they were terribly discriminated in military service. When they were inducted into service in the Tsarist army and later on the Polish army, and the very often that they had to resort to some sort of bribery to ameliorate the process, to have those Jews exempted from military service. And it's a very painful page in our history. But we were very fortunate, at least when we had the induction officers and those who were in charge of the medical examinations, who were able to be swayed through bribery. The Parsis, this was just decreed, evidently this seems as soon as they came into power, three decrees. They decreed against ritually prepared meat. They forbade slaughter, ritual slaughter. They forbade the use of baths. And they exhumed the dead. I've read explanations, and I don't know if this is based on actual material or this is based on original sources. The decree against richly prepared meat was because they felt that any slaughtering had to be done in their temple. And therefore, no animal could be slaughtered if it was outside the Zoroastrian temple. In that case, Jews really couldn't eat slaughtered meat. Of course, with bribery, they looked aside. In terms of exhuming the dead, they had a belief that the dead contaminates the earth. And therefore, they let them basically rot or whatever. It's just, outside, and they exhumed the dead. And as those who were buried, they actually exhumed. The prohibition of the use of baths is not clear. Is it because they felt they were a Spartan group and felt that it was just too Roman, it was too pampering? It's just not clear. What the Talmud does say, which this dates from the time of the prophets and to this day, was to find some sort of a link between why Jews suffer and what transgressions, what shortcomings the Jews have to warrant such treatment. And here, the Talmud goes and does, find certain relationships. That one sin would cause one thing or another. But one already would understand if they have to live under day-to-day life under these conditions, and only through bribery could they avoid it. One could understand the difficulty living under that regime. You have to realize they were in power, again, from the year 226 to the year, so 651. It's a long time. Even though part of Persia already fell before to the Arabs before that date. Just interesting, again, from a historical perspective, and you could look at the note, that there were discussions. Evidently, the Jews, of course, insisted upon their rights of burying the dead. And we do have recorded a discussion between one of the leading scholars of the day and one of the Parsi kings. This is King Shapur II. King Shapur II, by the way, historically, is very famous. He was the one who captured the Roman Emperor Valerian. The Romans were constantly fighting and later the Byzantines were constantly fighting the Persians, and he actually captured the Roman Emperor. But there is recorded a discussion between King Shapur and Rav Chama, one of the leading sages, about the issue of why are Jews required to bury the dead. Another very interesting part of their belief system was the idea of fire. And it's not clear from the Talmud is this on a regular basis or was only on specific times, but they forbade Jews from lighting lamps, from fire, again, privately in their own homes outside of the Zoroastrian temple. And if Jews had lamps lit, it was with dire consequences. In fact, the question is, and this is the top of page 2, and this is Gemara and Shabbos, and Mem Hei Amud Aleph, in Shabbos in 45a, the question was, that are you allowed to move a Hanukkah lamp on Shabbos because of the Parsis? In other words, is it really considered you are in danger? And it's because they used to light it outside. And Rav said an affirmative. It's a time of emergency. You are allowed to move it, even though it's muktzah, it's been set aside. Normally a lamp, even after it's been extinguished, you can't move. Most certainly when it's going on, you can't move it. But for Shabbos, he did allow it. In fact, according to many opinions, the reason we light the reason why we light Hanukkah lights in our own homes here outside of Israel and not outside why we moved it inside was because of these, what they're called, chaverim in the language of the Talmud. And again, it's not clear or chavre. Is it because it means the group, or does it mean a specific Persian name that's translated? But we moved it indoors because of this problem. So really it touches us, and we're going to see that there are other parts of Jewish life that are touched by our experience living under these people. To the extent that on one incident that there was one of these when a lamp was lit in a Jewish home, they had really a police force that came to see at night, you know, that if any lamps were lit, and they came to the house. And one of the great rabbis from Eretz Yisrael who was visiting, Rabbi Bar Bar Chona, said, "This is much better to live under the Romans, and we know how wonderful it is with the Romans, but it's much better to be under the Romans than with these people." So it gives you a sense of what life was, what life was like. I think it's just worthwhile to look at the two references. This is the end of page two. Again, that they, again, it just gives us an insight into the period. One is, there's a statement of Rava in the Gemara Nedorim in Samach Beis Amud Beis in 62b. The Persians levied a tax on everyone, but they did not levy the tax on the religious Parsis. In order to avoid the tax, and the Gemara says that really it's a tax which rabbis, it quotes to other biblical sources that in the community, really the teachers of the community, the rabbis of the community, should not be taxed. There's a certain privileges of the rabbinate. A rabbi, Tzurim Rabbonin, a scholar, is allowed to tell the Persians, the tax collector, says, "Avda denura ano, I'm a servant of fire." Even though to the tax collector it seems that what he's saying is that he's an idolater. I serve fire. Because fire, they looked at fire, was the embodiment of this spirit that they worshipped. Because it can be interpreted, it's like Nura would be a euphemism referring to Hashem himself, like the great fire. In the rabbi's mind, he says, "I serve Hashem." To the tax collector's mind, says, "I serve." Says that you. He's saying, "says I serve actual fire." Says, "but you're allowed to do so." He, of course, could not say straight, "I am a Zoroastrian," or he could not say something which clearly means that he's an idolater. In fact, that there is, I was just recently reading a responsa from the Or Zeruah, the Trumas Hadesh, who is the one of the Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin, who was one of the great scholars in 14th century Germany. And there's a whole question if a Jew, to avoid taxation or to avoid anti-Semitism, is allowed to dress distinctively like a non-Jew to avoid the impression that he is Jewish. And he brings this question, and then he deals again with the other question, are you allowed to tell to avoid anti-Semitism, are you allowed to say to them, "I am a non-Jew"? Is this considered, in a sense, a form of kfirah? It's a form of denying Judaism. And again, there's a whole discussion in the, is a person allowed to say that he's a Muslim? In this situation here, it was allowed, though, according to all opinions, because it has the impression, it's only the impression that he means that I am a worshiper of fire, but in his heart, he meant to say, I am worshiping Hashem Shu Eish Oichlo, who can be described as this consuming energy force, but it refers in his mind, to the scholar's mind, to Hashem, the tax collector's mind. to the God, but it gives you a sense of what life was like. The Jews were discriminated against. Yeah, the question was asked, I mean, wasn't it easy to, how could they just fool them? The question is very well placed. It's quite likely, though, that the best and brightest of Persian society did not go into tax collecting. Yeah. Another very interesting remnant of that period we have is there's a whole section in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, beginning from Lamed Ches Amud Beis in 38b, going to all the way to Lamed Tes, this is in 39, dealing with debates between Jews and non-Jews or Jewish heretics, and defense of the faith. And one, most of the questions there seem to be with the debate seem to be with early Christians or with Romans. Here we have clearly a debate with a Zoroastrian. This is in the bottom of page 2. Amaji, this is one of their priests, once said to Amemar. Amemar was the we touched upon this last time. He was a Rebbe. He was a rabbi colleague with Rav Ashi. And he said, you know, from the middle of your body belongs to, this is, to Hormuz, which is the positive God. From the middle downward belongs to, he says, Ahormuz, the negative God. As in the Zoroastrian system, there are actually two gods. And there was the struggle of the positive and the negative, which will only be resolved at the end of the days. But he said that really the gods really have control of different parts of the body. To this, Amemar said, well, when you drink water, you know, you start off on the top and it gets down to the bottom. How does he let it through his territory, you know? I don't know how theologically how correct this argument is, but again, it gives you a sense, a feel of the times. It seems from Rashi's expression also says that he's described for me, says he was being that Rabbi Yehuda, it seems the Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi asked of Levi. And it seems from the commentaries, Levi was originally a Babylonian, from the historians. And he says, how do the Persians look? Says, you come from that area. He says, Doimla Chayola Shel Beis David. They look, evidently, there was a nobility with the soldiers of the thing. They look like the armies of the House of David. How do the Parsi priests look? We're saying it from the year 226, they took power. Before that, they were there, except they were without power. So how do they look, these Chavre? So they look like, says Malachi Chabola. This is even before they took power. They look like destroying angels. One explanation is they're all dressed in black. Jews, by and large, did not dress in black then. Just interesting. But they all dressed in black. So I just want to give you a feel of the times. Again, let's just summarize what we have from the period. They made decrees against slaughtered meat, which evidently the Jews worked around with bribery. They forbade the use of baths. They decreed that all the dead should be exhumed. I'm not sure if it's all nights. On certain nights, they forbade the use of lamps in homes. And this is all because of the, or outside the home, this was all because of their belief system. They believed in fire. And to the extent that a person says, I'm a worshiper of fire, who is exempted from taxes. They believed in two gods. There's a positive and a negative god. The fire was the representation, I believe, of this positive god. And it seems that the Parsi priests were a ferocious lot, if they're described as Malachi Chavola, as these destroying angels, and they were the ones who finally took political control over Babylon. Even though the priests themselves seem to have been a very ferocious lot, we do find very positive relations, at least with some of the early Sassanid kings. And the Sassanid, the founder of this dynasty was named Sasan, so they're called Sasanians or Sassanids. The first king, Ardashir, we do not have anything clear in the Talmud if he had any relations with any Talmudic sage, but we do know that a city, there was a city on the Tigris, it was eventually the capital of their empire, called Ctesiphon. Across the river, across the Tigris River, there was another city. It was originally called Seleucus. It had been destroyed by the Emperor Trajan from the few years when they had control over Mesopotamia. It was rebuilt, and it was called Ardashir, named after the founder of this dynasty, who ruled from the year 226 to the year 241. It's interesting, again, how history has a certain relationship with halacha. There's a halacha about a tchum Shabbos, the boundary around the city. If you, for instance, if you are living in a desert and all you have is a hut, you are only allowed to travel 2,000 parses, 2,000 amos, 2,000 amos. It's like 1,000 paces. Like if you make like two steps is one pace. It's called a mil, 1,000 paces. There's a pace is you put 1 foot forward and then the other foot forward. That's a pace. 1,000 of those is a mil. A mil is from the Latin 1,000. Between 1 foot and the other, though, is one amma. So if you keep on, you take 1, 2, 3, it comes out, 2,000 ammas is your meal. So if you're in a hut, you have 2,000 ammas north, west, south, east to go. And in fact, you can make a box, so to speak. And within that box, you know, the midpoint of your box, center of your box is that hut. But you draw a box, and that box is some 4,000 cubits on every side. You can walk within that box. If there are two huts together, so if those two huts are Shivim Amim Visharayim, it's like 70 2/3 amos. And an amo is a question what it is, but it's between 1.5 and 2 feet. That if those huts are, that's considered like an extension of that hut, and it's considered like a minimum, like it's really a settlement. And you have a whole bunch of these huts together, and each one is 70 amos. 70 cubits from the neck, you have a settlement here. And if you're in the middle now, you're in the middle hut, you can walk from the end. When we draw our box or count 2,000 cubits, it's from the end of the settlement. The settlement can be a big settlement like New York City. It could be gigantic. But as long as the homes are fairly close together, then we have, it's considered a settlement. If let's say I have two settlements, I have one group of huts and another group of huts, and I have a no man's land in between. Here there's a clause that if I have and when you have two of them together, If I could have two intersecting circles, whatever it is, two lines, that if I, from one of them I have 70 plus, and the other 70 plus, and they intersect. As I have in between the last hut of one settlement and the last hut, first hut of this settlement, I have 141 and a third cubits. Then they merge together. I look at it as just a park area between the two. There was a question. We have these two cities here. Ardashir was on the west bank of the Tigris, and Akhtisfun, which was on the east bank. And there you have a river between them. And there was a problem here. Well, can I go over the bridge? And can I walk over? There was a way to walk over, I guess. Can I walk over from, if I happen to be spending Shabbos in Ardashir, can I walk over to Akhtisfun? You know, someone's giving you a history lecture. So this is on Shabbos. Can I walk over the bridge? So here the Talmud says, that the they show them that there were that at one time it seems that it was a contiguous city, and it had been flooded, it had been destroyed, and that area actually, it showed them that there were actually homes that were built, or there were structures that were built. Maybe they went over the river, but there were actually structures there that actually, that combined the two cities. But at this point, during Talmudic time, all you had was just ruined buildings. But ruined buildings are enough. In other words, so you can say that since it's a vestige of a city, a vestige of a city is also enough to consider it one long, continuous whole. And they showed them that in the Tigris River, says there were these. What was the vestige of what had been structures that kept on going through, and evidently they had been destroyed through Trajan's time, through another time before that, that was all destroyed. But again, I just wanted to show that it's interesting how much you learn from one passage of the Talmud. But the city was called on the west bank Ardashir. It was named for the first of this Sassanid dynasty. His son, King Shapur, or in the Talmud Shovar Malka, had a very warm relationship with the Talmudic scholar Shmuel. In fact, which is interesting, Shmuel showed his skill in front of King Shapur. This is in paragraph B. On page 3, that he juggled 8 glasses of wine without dropping anything. But evidently they had a very cordial relationship. And Shmuel evidently was really something else. You know? I mean, you know, the most is you see people juggling 3 tennis balls, 4. These are wine glasses that he was able to. But they did have a warm relationship, and it seems by and large, as is suggested here in paragraph C, the Zigmar Moed Kotna Chavov Amad Aleph, that he had told him that unless there were rebels, but he had never killed any Jews. And the only time, as the Talmud brings a story here, that they actually were rebelling against his authority as part of the, because they had taken sides with the Romans against his government. But he had, but he respected the Jews. At a later king, this King Shapur II was a, it seems, was a person who really did not have any feelings towards Jews. But his mother, Ifra Hormuz, had a very warm relationship with Rava, the great scholar, and the Rosh Masifta, the Rosh Yeshiva in Mechuzah. This is on page 4. We bring just various. We have a fascinating story here. You could read the story. This time doesn't allow to go through this. That Ifra Hormuz was able to prevail, upon the. upon her son to not to prosecute Rava. And she was very impressed with the Jews, and Rava was able, through his prayer, to wrought a minor miracle to impress the Shover Malka. But at least through the offices of the mother, again, his relationships were at least civil. When we have a later king, this is in the bottom of page 4, King Yezdegerd, who ruled from 399 to 421, he actually had a very warm relationship. As historians have it, he really wasn't a very religious Zoroastrian, and he was very open to other ideas. And here we have a quote that he actually adjusted the belt of Rav Huna Bar Nosson, who was the Reish Galusa, a great scholar in his own right. He says it's unbecoming of Jews that they should not dress like royalty, and adjusted his girdle, his belt. But it's indicative again of the relationship that they had. It was under these kings that much of the Talmud was put together. We dealt with the problem. Let's just take stock of what we have. We dealt with the problem of the country as a whole was controlled by these Chavre. It was called these Parsis, these very religious Zoroastrians who were fire worshippers. The kings, we find from different citations, though, were sympathetic with the Jews. However, the Jews had to deal with what we call probably a nuisance more than persecution, was the fact that, as it seems, that it was an armed state. And soldiers were constantly going through, constantly involved in protecting the borders and protecting the people. And there were soldiers that would come, troops of soldiers that would come and take over a city at a time. And the Jews were forced to house them. This occurred in Shmuel's time, who had a warm relationship with Shover HaMalka, with King Shapur the First. As we said, this is the citation on page A, that when the soldiers came, and it seems the rare event, but when they came, he couldn't... the community itself was not davening. They didn't get a minyan together that day. He had to daven by himself. When the army came to Nardon Rav Nachman's time, when he was a leader, that was some time later, so some 30 years after Shmuel's time, he told the scholars his thing that we're not going to have session in Nahardoa today because of the soldiers. We're going out to the marsh. In other words, we're camping out. And we're going out, and we're going to. This is before Shabbos, and he told on Shabbos we're giving the class, we're giving the shir not in the city, but we're giving it out in the outskirts, in the marshes. This is Nahardo. In Pumpadisa, again we have when the army came, we find Rabba and Rav Yosef fled the town. These are the scholars. Reb Zera, and this evidently is in the early years of Rav and Reb Yosef, whose father was a tax collector, a tzaddik, was a very righteous person, but he was a tax collector and evidently had government influence, and he wouldn't have been bothered and he wouldn't have to. But it seems that they were busy, housing the soldiers, taking care of the soldiers, so they left. In Mechuza, so we dealt with the city of Nahardoa and the city of Pumpadisa. In the city of Mechuza, we find, and there are different references, that again it was full of soldiers, and they used to put their private belongings in Jewish homes. Rava, who was the rabbi of Mechuza, told them that for Passover they have to rid themselves of the non-Jewish chometz. Maybe they have to pay the price, but they have to get rid of it from their home. There's really only one incident that's described that really that we find that someone, a scholar, suffered during this early period, the time that the Talmud was formed. And that was Rabbah, which was an incident we touched upon in a previous lecture. Rabbah, who was the Rosh Masifta of Pumpadisa, this Rabbah Bar Nachmeni, had many enemies. If you recall, we discussed there's a story there that the Talmud made a statement that from the eulogy that's given for a person, you can tell what kind of a person he is if the people cry. So Abaye asked Rabbah, says, who's going to cry at your levaya? At your funeral, everyone's going to be happy because you make it very difficult for them. As we've shown in other passages, the people of Pumpadisa, by and large, were criticized for their lack of honesty. As he says, if a member of Pumpadisa follows you, you know, and you check into one hotel, quickly check out and go to someplace else, that he shouldn't know where you are. It's not as bad as another city, as Nerish, he says, that if they give you a kiss, check your teeth. But he was very stern with them. Like the Bai himself, a Talmud of Rabbah, disciple of Rabbah, says that if people in the city like you, it's not a good sign. You're not doing your job as a rabbi. So he says, you know, when at your funeral, who's going to cry? So he says, it's enough that my close disciples cry. One of those who, evidently one who's he got on the wrong side of, made up this story to the government that because of the classes he was giving, the people were not, were not able to work. We've explained this before, that how it was during that period of time, during the month of Elul and the month of Adar, as a Hebrew month, this is the end of the summer and the end of the winter, they all gather together, all the Rosh Yeshivas, all the great scholars, all their disciples, and they went over in fine detail, they went over one tractate. That's why over a period of some 30 years, they would go over the whole Talmud. It was every single tractate. He says he's keeping them from working. You know, they're not making any money. And therefore, says the royal coffers are being deprived. And evidently, one of those that he got on the wrong side of. He informed them to the government. And it was really, they sent people out to find him, and he was, during the duress, and the thing that he died. He wasn't killed by them, but he was killed at that time, and he was on the run. But this is the only incident, and it had to do with an isolated incident because he had enemies. But by and large, we don't find during the period the scholars as a group had problems. A, they were able to bribe them. B, there were cordial relations with the kings themselves. And times were good. And here we have the quote thing from the Medrash Tanchuma in Parshas Noach. This is on page 6, that the two yeshivas were able to learn really without problem. And this is the end of this quote. Those two yeshivas, referring to Sura and Pumpadisa, did not see captivity, nor forced conversion, nor plundering. Neither Greece nor Rome ruled over them. However, this was soon to pass. This whole era passed. And towards after Rav Ashi's death, in the lifetime of those that followed him, a new regime came who were less tolerant than those that preceded them. If you just, I'll just give you a sense of the timing here. If you turn to the last page in your timeline, Rav Ashi, who was the subject of the last lecture, died in the year 427. In the year 455, Yezdegerd, who had come into some 11 years after the death of Rav Ashi, came into power, made decrees which affected Jewish life. And this has affected Shabbos and affected the recitation of the Shema. And here we find on page 7 a citation from Rav Shriragon about the period. And again, he gives a list of the Rosh Yeshivas, and he says, after Rav Idi Bar Oven, Rav Nachman Bar Rav Huna reigned in Sura. He died in the year 455. After his death, a decree of forced assimilation was imposed by the Persian king to force the Jews to violate Shabbos. The rabbis, in response, decreed a fast day. That night, the Holy One, blessed be He, brought under Him a serpent. This is the story that He brings, and he repeats this in a few places, that swallowed Him while He was lying in bed. The decree against the Jews became annulled. In other words, He died, He felt, as a result of their prayer. And when He died, Shabbos was able to be kept again. This is unprecedented. I mean, before, they dealt with laws that affected Jews and non-Jews. The prohibition of slaughtering wasn't directed against Jews. It was every Persian. And baths, says exhuming the dead, and it applied to everyone, Jew and non-Jew alike. Here we have decrees that affected Jews. There was another decree besides that of Shabbos, which left its mark in history. And it's something that we commemorate to this very day. I don't know if you've ever thought it odd, but there are two times, besides, there are three times in Shabbos davening. Say the Shema, there's a section before the actual davening, before Pesukei Dezimra. There's a Riboin Kolomim, that a person should Yolim, says that a person should keep the Torah, a person should be fearing God in private. And it ends off what do we say every day, Shema Yisrael. There's a mention of Shema in the beginning. Shema, of course, is part of the regular davening. At the end, on Shabbos Musaf, we mention again the fact that we say Shema. Vayomer Pamayim b'chol yoyim, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hu Elokeinu, Hu Avinu, Malkeinu, Moshiyenu. We mention the fact that we say Shema. It originated from this Persian period. And let's read together, this is from a responsa of the Gonim. We only say Pamayim, says B'chol Yoyim, and then Liyos Lochem L'Lokim, you know, this part, on Kedusha of Musaf on Shabbos and Yom Tov, and not in the weekdays. It is based on the following account. After the death of Rav Nachman, this Yezdegerd, the king of Persia, decreed that we should not recite the Shema. In response, the sage instituted to be subsumed in the middle of Kedusha. The first, as we just mentioned, at least we should remember it. Those who are knowledgeable will say it in their homes, behind closed doors. And in fact, historians claim that what we say, Le'elo Me'odim, this is Yorushimayim B'Seser, a person should fear God in private, really comes from those days that in the shul itself we were not allowed to say Shema. They let us say Shemoneh Esrei, let us say other things. They did not let us say Shema. We said it at home. And this is a throwback to those days. But in the shul we did not say Shema. Those who were unlettered, who didn't know, I mean, could you know, go through, be, I mean, they were afraid to go through a whole lifetime and not say Shema. I mean, they didn't, you know, they weren't knowledgeable and they didn't daven at home and they went to shul, and shul they didn't hear it. The Jews couldn't say it because of the Persians. And again, the reason that they didn't say Shema, as we found in the, as we stated before, the Zoroastrian believed in two gods. Jews saying Shema were making a commitment, a declaration that they only believe in one. And they felt it was offensive to their faith. So it was alluded to in Musaf. We say Shema, they didn't say the whole thing. And then they ended up, Ani Hashem Elokechem. So you have Shema Yisrael, and you have Ani Hashem Elokechem. Like it's, you know, Hashem Elokechem MS. So you have the beginning and the end of the Shema, so that the children, as those who would only have their upbringing in the shul, would at least hear, they know the existence of a Shema. So they'll go and ask and find out. But at least it shouldn't be totally forgotten. After it was annulled, they said that for all generations, at least there'd be some remnant of this. It seems they used to say this in the weekdays as well. But once it was annulled, there was a remnant, at least on Musaf and Shabbos and Yontif and Ne'ilah. So the Musaf part, which is not, there's no Shema on the part of it in the davening itself, they wanted to retain this. And this is the custom of the two yeshivas, Asura and Pumbedisa. This is written in the time of the Gaonim, and that's the source. Every time on Shabbos, Musaf says, you'll say Shema, hopefully you remember this history lecture too. Fortunately, this King Yezdegerd died due to the prayers of the Rosh Yeshivas. They were not so fortunate with one of his successors. The King Peroz, he's called Perez Rishia, the evil Perez. I'm not dealing with Israeli politics now. imprisoned. The Rosh Yeshiva Pumbedisa, while Rav Sama was the Rosh Yeshiva, there were great scholars he imprisoned: Rabbona Amemer Bar Mar Yanuka, Huna Bar Mar Zutra the Reish Galusa, and Misharsha Bar Pakud, which is also mentioned in the Talmud. The Reish Galusa and Misharsha were put to death in Ador. So they were put together in Teves, and in Ador, so this was like the end of this is like December, January, in Ador, in February, March, Amemer Bar Mar Yanuka was killed. This is again unprecedented. The murder of Jewish leadership again was unprecedented. Just how the things went from bad to worse. In the year 474, all of the synagogues of the city of Babylon were closed. And the children were taken from their parents and brought up by the Magi. They were forced to be taken from their homes. Rav Isaac Halevi says that it's referring not to the country Babylon, but to the city, which means the royal, the area which was under their control, the royal city. But what it does mean is that, again, this is that we have a situation which is unprecedented suffering. It's at this time that the Talmud comes to a close. It's the same year that Ravina II, if you look in the timeline, page 13, died. He was the last of the Talmudic authorities whose decisions were basically considered final. Those who came after him no longer disagreed. In other words, they did not see in themselves they were of the same caliber as the authors of the Talmud, and they really did never made, and this is really, this is to this day, there are no decisions in halacha which go counter to the decisions of those who compose the Talmud. Because any decision which is in halacha today, in Jewish law today, is based, the precedent is based on precedent of Talmudic law. If it's clear that what the person is espousing is contradicted by Talmudic law, then it has the later ruling has no validity. This all law, right, is Talmudic, and this really began in the time, at times where there was still one yeshiva. There were times after Ravina died. It seems that Sura was close, or was to the place of all these Tzoras, and there's this city of Babylon, did not reopen as a center of Torah for many years. So there was one yeshiva in Pumpadisa. So it was one central area now, in North Babylon versus South Babylon. And in this one, they did not disagree with the masters of the Talmud. At later times, it was be an impossibility, because the Talmud, since was the last Sanhedrin, this was the last central group where all the great rabbis came to discuss these issues, and the final ruling is the ruling of basically of the central rabbinic body. Afterwards, really, there's no central rabbinic body. Jews lived in this country, in that country. In the Gaonic times, they had the yeshiva in Sura and Pumpadisa. Rarely did they ever come together. So for practical purposes, I mean, besides, even if we would be the equal of the sages of the Talmud, but the fact is that we would be individuals arguing with a Sanhedrin, as a central body, we would not have the power. We could never do this. But besides that, it seems that when, after the death of Ravina, when at times it was a central body, the sages still did not disagree with the previous generations. They felt that they were not worthy of disagreeing. They didn't have the temerity to disagree. And the ruling goes with those of the Talmud. And that's why Ravina's death is called Soif HaRoa, the end of the process of issuing halachic edicts. And from that time on, there will be no edicts that contradict a previous Talmudic ruling. So all Talmudic law is based on what was said from Ravina and before. I give you again, you can look through the timeline. We've gone through some of the names of the scholars of the period. Maybe we could just go through this very quickly here. So we have here in the year 525 Rav Yosef, who succeeded, who was from, who's from the next generation, who's mentioned in the Talmud in a few places. Rav Eina, Rav Simonoi, this is the first time in Surah, in the time in the year 525, after some 50 years, that again a yeshiva comes together in Surah. In Pumpadisa, there was constantly in northern Babylon, there were yeshivas. What the Rabbonin Savaroy did was is that they added to the Talmud basically these explanations, commentary. To make it, they assured this is a document, even though it was originally all Baal Peh, it was all oral. But this was a work that would be standard for all generations. And they had to make sure that it would be intelligible. So, it seems that there were actually three basic things that they did. And again, you can look through the notes on page 9. There are three basic things that they did. A is they added commentary to the Talmud. I mean, not much, but a little here, a little there to make it flow. And there are discussions by them, again, just giving understanding of, you know, of previous discussions. Again, nothing to issue their own rulings against previous rulings, but very often to quote previous rulings that may not have been included. The second is they set it up in the Talmud. Generally, when you read the Talmud, and the Talmud is printed right after the Mishnah, and it would go, the Talmud would discuss various parts of the Mishnah. We find at certain key places, we find part of the Mishnah quoted in indicating now we're going to discuss this part of the Mishnah. So there's a break. The Talmud Yerushalmi, which didn't have this final editing, doesn't have these explanations, nor does it have breaks, so it's very hard to clue. What is this going on? Is this a continuation of what was said before? Is this beginning something new? The breaks were added. And finally, according to Isaac Halevi, it seems that it was they who put it into writing. So they made commentary. Some was included in the Talmud. Some we find their responses that actually that were not included in the text of the Talmud, but were studied again by rote or whatever, they wrote this down, or they knew it by memory, explanations of certain passages of the Talmud, again, that were handed down from this generation. So it wasn't sometimes it was, and sometimes it wasn't in the body of the text, but it was just as a rather a running commentary. That's why they're called Savaroy, those who give understanding, the commentators. So they did that. They actually fixed the text, so to speak. That you could tell on what part the Talmud the Gemara is going on. It gives headings, so to speak, and breaks. And the other thing, of course, is as revised this is the writing. I mean, time doesn't allow to go through just the details, and that's something if you're interested, you can go through the notes about who were the ones and they died and when they lived and where they were the Rosh Hashivas. I'd like to touch, though, now on two points here. One is there's a passage in the Talmud. There's a Gemara in Tainus, in Chov Beis Omer Aleph, in 22a. There is a scholar by the name of Rabroika Choizoi, Rabroika the seer, who was speaking to Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, in the marketplace. And Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah told this Rabroika, says, you see that person there? That person is a Ben Olam Haba. He's a person who belongs. He's a spiritual person of the next world. He's a tzaddik. He's a person whose place he has a firm place in the next world. He wasn't anything to look at. In fact, he didn't look like a Jew. Didn't have tzitzis. He was wearing black. He looked like a Persian. He didn't look Jewish. He went over to him and says, I'd like to speak to you. He says, I'm sorry, I don't have the time. I'll be in this neighborhood tomorrow at this time. We could talk. He came to him tomorrow, the next day, and he asked him, says, what do you do? So he says, I'm a prison guard. And there are prisoners, I have women prisoners and men prisoners. I make sure, says, that they're... that the men and women are kept separate. And if there's a Jewish woman, says, I make sure that she's protected. But he says, but for that, why do you have to look like a non-Jew? What he says is that I am really close to the government, the governing powers. They think I'm a non-Jew. That's why I dress the part. And when they're planning anything against the Jews, since I'm privy to their plans, I tell the rabbis, and the rabbis pray and annul their decree. This is the language of the Talmud. How he describes himself, though, is he says, Zandekoi ano, which Rashi interprets based not on knowledge of the language, but in terms of the context, is I am a prison guard, even though it's, again, it's not a word which occurs anywhere in the Talmud. Rav Isaac Halevi has a very interesting theory, as I wanted to share with you. And again, it gives you a sense of the times. We've discussed so far the Parthians, who were very tolerant of the Jews. We discussed the Parsis, the Chaverim, the Zoroastrians, who were very intolerant. They could be dealt with bribery. Sometimes bribery didn't help, like the story of King Yezdegerd. In the year 500 or so, there developed a new movement within Persia. The king was King Kavad. He reigned from the year 488 to the year 531. And he was under the sway of a so-called prophet called Matzdak. Who had this whole new communist theory. Communism really wasn't new. It says everyone should share everything. And they had these communist cells, so to speak. And they became a group within a group. I mean, they were still Zoroastrians, but they had this new agenda. The poor loved it. You can imagine how the rich felt. When they all came, he says, we got to share everything. He says, you got to share wives. You got to share everything. You know, this was it. There was amongst the wealthier class, there was a movement, they imprisoned this Kavad. But the poor were so incensed that they set him free and continued the movement. It was only until his successor, Chosru, in the year 531, that he savagely suppressed this, evidently, and killed out all the followers of this Matzdak. The followers of Matzdak were called the Zendak. And Rav Isaac Halevi wants to say the Zandekoi of this Talmud actually is referring that I am a member of this group. But I'm a mole in the party, so to speak. And that's why he dressed the part. And because he's part of this ruling class, his job was within the prisons, but he was privy to conversations on a much higher scale. Because he was really part of this party. This was this period, in the circuit, if you look in the thing, in the year 500, was within the first in the first years of the Rabbanan Savaroy. And it's under this period of time that this whole revolution occurred. Another very interesting event, which is not recorded in the Talmud, it seems to be alluded to, at least in terms of what the aftermath was alluded to in the letter of Rav Shura Gaon, but whose details were kept in this work called Seder Olam Zuta. The Seder Olam Rabba, the great Seder Olam, the order of the world, was a work written by Rav Yossi Bar Chalafta, the Tana, the author of the Mishnah, the Talmud of Rabbi Akiva, which is a history of a shortened history of the world until his time. The Seder Olam Zuta, the minor Seder Olam, the order of the world, which was a work which deals with Gaonic times. And I'd like to read together this story. Fascinating story here on page 12. And again, one has to know, this is the singular source. It's not from a person of the stature like Rav Shmira Gaon, so one has to know in terms of its, when you only have one source in terms of ultimate reliability, but it's with great detail, and in all probability at least the majority of the details are correct. Rav Kahana Reish Galusa died, and Rav Huna Mar, his brother, and generally when Rav Shmira Gaon speaks of the Gaon of the Reish Galusas, he generally does not call them Rav unless they were Talmidei Chacham, unless they were scholars. Rav Huna Mar's brother subsequently inherited the position. When he died, it was in the year 508. Rav Huna Bar Rav Kahana, his nephew, inherited the position. The Rav Isaac Halevi, this is how it's written in the Seder Olam, and Rav Isaac Halevi wants to say that really it should be, he calls everybody Rav. Rav Shmira Gaon, referring to the first one, called him Rav. This person we'll see clearly, was not a great person. Through him, the house of David was destroyed. And the following is the account of the events. The wife of Rav Huna, Reish Galusa, the second Rav Huna, was the daughter of Mar Rav Chanina, who was Reish Masifta. In Rav Shmira Gaon, we don't have his name listed. Rav Chanina was a man of vast scholarship and saintliness. The judge of the Reish Galusa, as the Reish Galusa had his own court, and this is referred to when we in the class and the lecture of the Reish Galusa, they had his own court of law, went to the city of Rav Chanina and desired to deliver lectures to the student body of that city. I mean, he was a visiting Rav, and he felt that he wanted to lecture. The Reish Masifta did not let him, and again, it's not clear why he did not. And again, this is the only source. He, the judge, subsequently went back to the Reish Galusa, the head of the auxiliary, and told him what had occurred. The Reish Galusa issued orders and sent for the Reish Masifta and commanded he be put into a ditch or a dungeon of the city for the entire night. This was his father-in-law. The next day he was brought before him. Evidently he felt it was slighting his own honor that not letting his person, the judge of his court, speak in public. And the Reish ordered that they pull out all the hair of the Reish Masifta's beard, and he not be giving any lodging in the city. Those people tortured him. Thereupon the Reish Masifta went and sat down in the great synagogue and wept. He went to shul. Death immediately befell the house of the Reish Galusa, and they all died in one night. And again, I'm saying this is the only source, so we have nothing to compare it to. Mar Zutra remained of the entire house of David in the womb of his mother. The daughter of this Rav Chanina, was the Reshma Sifta. She survived. I mean, in other words, doesn't know what the death was. It was through violent means. Was it through some sort of a plague or poisoning? It's not clear. Rav Chanina saw him in his dream. She was pregnant, and when he was born, he took him unto him because he was the last survivor of this house of the Resh Galusa, because they all died out. And the author of this work, Seder Olam Zuta, felt there was a punishment. There was a response to the torture and the cries of Rav Chanina. Taught him scripture and eventually made him into a great man, as it taught him everything. When Mar Zutra was 15 years of age, he, together with the Resh Masifta, in other words, again, Rav Chanina, and this would be the Resh Masifta, it would seem from anything, of the Resh Masifta of Surah. The list after Ravina, Rav Shura Goyen does not list any heads of the Masifta. You know, at least he only lists one or two. He can see in the timeline. It says, but he evidently was during this period of time. The author calls him a Resh Masifta. Perhaps it really wasn't a true Masifta, so to speak. It didn't have that. Didn't have that force of the scholars, but it was a yeshiva. He went to the king and took back the position of leadership from Rav Pachta. Because Rav Pachta had taken over that position, and now evidently Rav Pachta himself was not from the royal family. So he demanded from the king, and the king acquiesced. Mar Zutra became Resh Galusa for 20 years, and Mar Rav Chanina, and Rav Sama, and Rav Yitzchak were his resident scholars. In his days, Rav Yitzchak, the Resh Masifta, was killed. And he explains how it occurred. How did the Resh Masifta die? Says, there was evidently there was problems with the government. And as Rav Isaac Halevi points out, at this time in Persian history, the central government was weak. And the little provincial governors had immense power. And he went and fought against this Resh Galusa, saw a vision, a column of a fire that appeared unto him. He took it as a sign to rebel against the royal governor. And 400 men came out together with him, and they waged war, and they took over the government of that province. They became the governor. He became, besides Resh Galusa, the head of all Jews, of all of Babylon, he became the head of that province and collected taxes for 7 years. At the end of the 7 years, an incident occurred as he became, as a governor, that the tax collectors with him, this is the only source, and I keep on repeating this because one has to know if these are the true details, sinned, and it was found that they had drunk non-Jewish wine, which is rabbinically forbidden, and had committed immoral acts in the royal house of non-Jews. Really, they had relations with non-Jewish women. And the column of fire that had gone before him vanished. Evidently, the central government waged war against him, and the Persians captured him and killed him. They hung or crucified Mar Zutra, who was the Resh Galusa, and the Resh Masifta, that was Rabbi Yitzchak, on the bridge of Mechuza. And it was in Mechuza, which was by the Tigris, which was the area that he had taken up residence, it would seem. The king commanded, and the city of the Resh Galusa was taken into captivity. The whole city was made its slaves. The day that Mar Zutra, the Resh, was killed, a son was born unto him. They called him Mar Zutra on the name of his father, but they fled. For 30 years, Mar Achinoi wasn't able to reveal his face, and Mar Giza, the brother of the father of the house of Mar Rav Nahailoi, went and sat in Nahar Tsova. They were all in exile because of this incident. Mar Zutra, the son of Mar Zutra, Resh Galusa, went up to the land of Israel, and they elevated him to a position of Resh Pirka, like a Rosh Yeshiva. not Resh, the difference of Resh Masifta is where you are the head first amongst scholars. So besides, you have Talmidim, you have the disciples, you have scholars of the first rank that gather together. Resh Pirka is that you are, would be a Rosh Yeshiva today, would be that you are a scholar with disciples. And he became the Rosh Yeshiva. This is the story as we have from Masechta. Again, it's a singular source, but one thing we do see is there was much turmoil during the time. There was a time, again, the Jews rebelled, and finally it was like some 30 years until things got back to normal. Rav Shrira Gaon refers to this time of upheaval as a time of severe problems. During this time, there was no yeshiva of Sura. If they crucify or they hang the Rosh Yeshiva, there was no yeshiva. Even in Pumpadisa, that was to the north, there were problems, and they had to move the Masifta, the scholars had to go to a to an adjoining area. It's called Piroz Shavur, the adjoining area outside of Nahar Dor, which they hadn't been there for quite a long time because of the political situation. It was many years later, it was really at the same time, probably this Mar Zutra went up to Israel, that they were able again to, the things were able to come back to normal. And it's that time, if you look at the timeline here, and again, I have this incident inserted in this timeline so we could see. And we're 558, the death of Mar Zutra of Hanina, says Rav Yitzchok, the Resh Masifta. Mar Zutra bar Mar Zutra, 30 years later, becomes the Resh Pirka. It's in the next year, in 589, the Rav Hanan of Ishkaya became the first Gaon of Pumpadisa. This is the first of the Gaonim, the new period. And up until this time, the year 589, is considered the time of the Rabbonin Savaroy. So again, let me just to recap what we touched upon. We discussed the fact that in the early years of the Talmud, by and large, it was peaceful. Before the Talmudic period under the Parthians, it was fine and there were no problems. In the beginning of the Talmudic period under the Parsis, the Zoroastrians, the Chavrei, there were difficulties. There were difficulties with slaughtered meat. They were exhuming the dead. They were bathing with fire. But by and large, through bribery and through connections to the government, they were able to work around this. At the end of the Talmudic period, we have this King Yezdegerd II, who decreed against saying Shema in public, decreed against keeping Shabbos, that we have the first inkling of real problems. Later on, says through a successor of his, we find that this is the King Pirus, that we find for the first time that Jewish leadership is put to death. We touched upon this thing of the of Mazdak, this communist social religious movement that the Jews were able to cope with during this time. And finally, he says, we dealt with this Mar Zutra, who's the Resh Galusa, who again, unprecedented, who became a political entity, not just a Jewish political entity, but a political entity, collected tax for 7 years in his area, was finally killed mercilessly, and Jews suffered for another 30 years. This was the period of the Rabbonin Savaroy. Under the most difficult circumstances, they still gathered where they could. They still taught. They still preserved the entire Talmud verbatim till finally it was written down. They added commentaries to the Talmud and arranged it in a way that it would be, with breaks, would be much more readable. We do have from them, besides their names, in a few places, like this Rav Yosef is mentioned in the Talmud. If you look through the notes, you could see it in greater detail. But it was not a period of time in a sense that we have much from. The period of the Gaonim, though, is in terms of literary output, was a very rich period. And Mirat Hashem, in a future date next year, we will go through the Gaonim.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, you were discussing about the transgressions that are mentioned this last page, about the story with the men of Marzutra. It seems the transgressions that were spoken of were atypical. They were because these were men of power, because they had to deal now with non-Jews. And the Jews were basically, they could deal with their own. Here, they collected taxes. They had to deal with, as leaders of a non-Jewish province. And power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Lord Bacon said it was because of the position that they were in that this occurred. I don't believe that this was a widespread phenomenon. Yes. Okay, the question was asked about, during this whole period of time, what happened in Israel? The answer is, we don't know. We know that when the Christians came to power after Constantine, life was unbearable. And finally, basically all the scholars left Israel and came to Babylon. The first mention of a group that needed a Rosh Yeshiva is this mention here in the Seder Olam Zuta of a beginning of a group of scholars that needed someone of stature. Besides this reference, at least from the references that we have, there is very little. We do find, though, that during the period of the Rabbonin Savaroy, there are casual remarks made. This is called Gemara and Chulin, on two occasions. It says Sholchu Mimarova, they sent from Eretz Yisroel, confirming a statement that was said in Babylon. So there's a hint that in a time of, and this is the post-Talmudic, this time of the Rabbonin Savaroy, that there were, I guess, the beginnings of a scholarly community that had correspondence to the community in Babylon. And in fact, they quoted them authoritatively enough to say that, that on certain occasions, that what you're saying, has merit. But it's really, like, I believe, as I recall, there's only two occasions that this occurred, and we have no details. This is the first time we have a name, his name, we have a person, Marzutra. So it would seem that during this period of Savaroyim, things got a little better in Christian Palestine, which allowed scholars to develop. This is the first time that we know of a Babylonian who became a head of a yeshiva in Israel. But again, the knowledge we have is very sparse. Yes. Right.
As you say, it's a retinuous piece. This is about the latest time I've heard of any tracing of the line of David
The question was about the reference of the line of the house of David. The Resh Galusa, this whole, the house of the exilarch, were descendants of King David. This means they were king, is descendant of King David, Ben Acher Ben, and others on the paternal side. It's not clear, this is something we'll discuss during the Gaonic period, that line survive or not. Or did it totally die out? Rav Shmuel Gaon speaks of a child that was left over from that family, who after his time became the Resh Galusa. It seems the last Resh Galusa. This is circa the year, this is 1000. His descendants, or what occurred to him, is really is not that clear what happened to them. But there's always this, you know, the mention of the house of David being killed out. It seems that really these are the only, besides this group, I mean, always the mention of the house of David. It's not clear there were any other family that could equally trace their yichus, their genealogy, all the way back to King David. You know, this is a very interesting problem in terms of Moshiach, about the Messiah. We know, you know, there's the thing that Rashi is descendant from King David. Rashi had no sons, only had daughters. Anyone who's a descendant of Rashi has, I guess, Davidic blood runs in his veins, but he's not worthy of the, you know, of being the title of Mashiach. And I don't know of really anyone who has a yichus, that's truly reliable, all the way back, ben achar ben, in other words, on the paternal side. The Rambam says, which is based on that, it's really from the house of David. To be part of Mashiach, not only does the person have to be the saint and the scholar and the political leader, but he must clearly be from the house of David. So I don't know how that will be demonstrated in the future.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.